Fabulous business book for you this evening. Our long walk to economic freedom. Lessons from 100,000 years of human history. It is by Johan Fourie. Johan is an economic historian, a professor of economics and history at Stellenbosch University. I'm seeing two pressure points here, Johan. Our long walk, nice play on Nelson Mandela as we head to Freedom Day tomorrow, and economic freedom, which of course is the EFF's raison d'être, if you like, their reason for existence. Is, I mean, deliberate choice of provocative title?
Good evening, Bruce. Yeah, I guess you can say that. I think I'll just say it's the hope is there to start a discussion about what is prosperity, what are the reasons for prosperity, why is economic growth so important? And so this is really an attempt to get at these long run history lessons that we, you know, go back all the way to 100,000 years, and a lot of them are from the more recent past. But that's really the point, is to have a discussion.
I've not ever played, how do you pronounce the game? Catan, C-A-T-A-N, or Catan, or Catan, or how do you pronounce it?
Catan.
Catan. I've never played Catan, the board game. I've enjoyed Monopoly for many years. It's the entry-level economics game, and many people believe that the world is a bit like Monopoly, in that you go in, it's cutthroat, you buy property, you put up property, you charge rentals, and you gouge all the money you possibly can out of your competitors' pockets, and you win the game when you dominate, when you have a monopoly. We know the world doesn't really work like that. It's kind of like that, but explain to me, please, how you see the world in these two board games, Catan and Monopoly, because it's a fabulous scenario that you paint.
Yeah, I think most people, you're right, see the world as a game of Monopoly, where, you know, the strongest, the bravest, maybe, you know, the most evil, they win all the money at the end of the game. But in fact, if you look at kind of, you know, world history, global economic history, it's not at all like that. We grow rich by cooperating, by trusting one another. It's an incredible society living, actually, the one at present, where we, you know, can take an Uber, where we don't actually know the driver, and we simply trust that driver to take us where we want to be. And that's exactly what Settlers of Catan is. It's a game where, you know, everyone starts with one village and one road. And at the end of the game, you know, there is a winner, the first guy to get 10 points. But ultimately, everyone else has got, you know, big civilizations, villages and cities. So that's far more representative of what economic growth and economic history is than Monopoly as a game.
Because you bring lots of contemporary popular culture in as reference points, and I think that's going to be the success of your book, is going to be the idea that you bring in the fictional land of Wakanda, introduced to us, of course, in the Marvel movies. And I love how you use popular culture as reference points, because everybody wants to live in Wakanda, and we kind of think that Wakanda is impossible. But I think you point out that, I mean, if Singapore's a bit like Wakanda, it is entirely possible through making sensible policy choices over long periods of time.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, that's exactly right. It's that, you know, Wakanda, you know, when the movie came out, you could see kids across Africa basically, you know, emulating, you know, the cross-hearted signs, and it's such an inspirational movie for many people. And I guess part of that is that, you know, we want to dream about an Africa that is prosperous. And the point of the book is that, firstly, I think we tend to think that Africa has always been impoverished, and that's, you know, simply not true. Africa in the 1950s were more at higher levels of income, for example, than Asia. And so, you know, there's already just a lesson in there that, you know, it's not this kind of deterministic or fatalistic story that we perhaps, you know, have borrowed from the last two or three decades where African countries have struggled. So that's the one point. And I think the second one is that, yes, we can achieve a more prosperous Africa. In fact, you know, many of the independence leaders just after colonization ended in Africa had these visions of a pan-African, you know, society where the African individuals had high levels of income that you know, we're at the same level than many other rich countries in the world. And I think that's certainly doable. In fact, I would be optimistic to say that is indeed possible. Of course, if we adopt the lessons of the past and do not again, you know, do the kind of implement the policies that actually prevented that from happening.
Okay, so take me through the thinking here, because yes, you use lots of popular culture, but you weave real economic theory and serious academia into the book as well. It's a serious book on a serious topic, but in a very relatable format. You make the point, and it's a wonderful point that you make, and that in the full sort of extent of human history, human beings have, until recently, in evolutionary terms, we've been poor. We've been incredibly poor until about the last 200 years, where suddenly there's this exponential improvement in living standards in most parts of the world.
Yeah, it's. I think it's the strange thing is that when I teach this at university, my students don't know the story, right? So they tend to think that the world is just getting worse and worse, and so to some extent it's plausible, right? We live in a country where for the last decade or so, actually incomes have declined, and so there is some something to support their experience. But if you look at the longer run, over the last 200 years, you're right. You know, the world has become on average 18 times richer. So put that in perspective, your great 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 grandparents could perhaps afford one pair of shoes, and those were shoddy shoes, right? And today we can afford.
They made them themselves. They slaughtered the animal, dried the hide, made the rimpies, and exactly, made their own bloomin' shoes.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's not only in terms of income levels, right? It's also in terms of just the kind of quality of living. Health has obviously improved. Access to education is far superior than what it was 200 years ago. So. I think that was an important story. So, of course, this is not the first book to say that. There's several of these books to say, to tell that story. But I do think it's a book where we try and get at why that has happened. And that's where the kind of history, economic history, can really help us.
So why has it happened? Why have the last 200 years led to this considerable acceleration in human prosperity?
Well, I don't want to give away, the answer. But let me summarize it in kind of two ideas, I guess. And that is the first idea is that our understanding of nature has helped us become so productive compared to our ancestors. So our understanding of nature, another word for that is science. So we can just be producing far more than we could in the past. But that's not the only thing. And I think the second idea is even more important, and that is that whatever we produce should not be limited to an elite few, but in fact shared among the public at large. And for a long time, elites expropriated anything, any surpluses that society produced. And the idea over the last two centuries certainly has been that this wealth should be democratically shared amongst everyone. And I think those two ideas kind of summarize broadly why it is that, science and the democratization to some extent of that science, of the consequences of that science is why we are so prosperous today.
And there's also another point. I mean, no country started rich. Some countries were endowed with more natural resources than others, and perhaps the curse of South Africa is the natural resources upon which we've become so heavily dependent, and we haven't innovated like the South Koreans, the Chinese, the Singaporeans. I mean, Singapore had nothing going for it, really, other than some very smart global gamesmanship and creating opportunity where it didn't actually exist, in a boggy marshland on a small island in the middle of Asia. We've got natural resources, lucky us, but it's meant we've been able to possibly rest on our laurels more than we might otherwise have done over generations than places like Singapore.
Yeah, I think, there's obviously a deep history of scholars working on whether natural resources are actually important. I think, in a different context, you can look at Sierra Leone and Botswana, and both have diamonds, but the one is far wealthier than the other, right? So I don't actually think natural resources per se tell us that much. You could have a country like Australia who has a lot of natural resources, and they've seem to be doing quite well, and others do not. So I think there's something else That's important. So I tend to, when students kind of mention the natural resources, I tend to be cautious about that as an explanation for why some are doing, you know, very well and others are not.
Well, it comes down to policy choices. It comes down to vision. It comes down to leadership. It comes down to determining a future that is beyond just a dependence on resources, though, surely.
Yeah, you're right. It's very difficult. And I'm trying to think of this as in terms of like an economic model where you have all these variables that you throw in and you see which ones kind of, you know, come out positive. And it's not clear that we know exactly. It's you know, what it is. It's, you know, some countries have done very well with the right policies. Others would have, you know, said, well, maybe it's, you know, science, investment in science. Others would say, well, maybe it's not just science, it's the commercialization of that science. And others would say, well, it's openness. And so there are many kind of plausible theories. But I think kind of, you know, part of the point of this book, again, is to kind of bring it back to first principles and say, perhaps, you know, if we look at something like the Industrial Revolution, it's clear that there's this kind of culture of science, right, that people are adopting certain practices that allow them to innovate, to produce new technologies, to become more productive, to produce larger surpluses, to trade away those surpluses, and so grow prosperity. So I think that's, you know, it's a very kind of short answer to a much bigger question, but I think that's really what I would respond to that.
But I think it's a hopeful book. I think it's a book that tells us we've got choices. And, you know, we don't need to sitting in this vortex of negativity about our own environment, this vortex of negativity around the state of the economy today. Countries that make smart choices, countries that make good choices, countries that make choices for the future are invariably more successful than those that don't, that either shy away from the hard choices or make bad choices.
Mm. Yeah, so you tend to emphasize kind of countries who make these choices. I want to emphasize that it's kind of the people in those countries that make the choices, right? So,
no, of course. Forgive me. Yes, you're absolutely right.
And I think that's really, that's vitally important, because I think what we tend to hope for is a top-down strategy that's kind of, that works. And my sense is that it's a bottom-up strategy that's important, where you give people the chance to make the choice of what they want to produce, what they want to invest in, what they want to consume. And ultimately, it's the collective behavior of individuals that make the difference.
Okay, and then I'm not going to, again, I don't want to give away your great secrets and your great stories, but there are three compelling questions, and I'm going to ask you to answer just one of them, just as a little sweetener, whether it be about how Einstein was instrumental in creating Eskom, whether there's a connection between an Indonesian volcano and the Groot Trek, or the similarities between King Goodwill-Zwelithini, the late King Goodwill-Zwelithini, and Charlemagne. I'll let you choose one of those. You can pick which one, and you can tell us why.
So I actually taught about the Indonesian volcano today, so perhaps I should. I think that's probably the better one then. So that's, I mean, that's a really fascinating story, I guess. It's 1815. It started from Fikane. But it's also the year without a summer in Europe, right? 1816, mass starvation and famine, together obviously with the invention of, say, the bicycle and Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein. So that's kind of the one. She writes that simply because she's, you know, on holiday in Geneva with Lord Byron, and they play a game one evening of kind of writing a scary story. And so she comes up with Frankenstein. So why, you know, what happens in Southern Africa? So this is kind of a global phenomenon, this massive environmental change in 1815. And that includes Southern Africa. We know that from tree rings, for example, and various other sources. And of course, that's the kind of ignites, you know, Shaka and his campaigns and massive displacement of people. Again, famine and drought is kind of linked to that. So resource scarcity. And that has obviously massive implications for the distribution of people in South Africa. And part of that 20 years later is that, you know, there are these bands of frontier settlers who are kind of opportunistic, and they see the amplification to some extent, or desification of the kind of interior of South Africa. And people have moved now to rugged areas to protect themselves from these kind of periods of conflict and warfare. And so they move into the interior. And so one might ask, so what was the cause of this drought and famine globally in 1815, and then it turns out only, you know, much later did people actually connect all the dots that it was an Indonesian volcano, Tambora, that erupted, largest ever eruption recorded in human history. As I told the students today, it blew off about 1.5 kilometer of the mountain, right? So that's basically, you know, 1.5 times Table Mountain that just kind of, you know, went up in the air. And so you can understand why global climate change happened within basically a year or two. And so that's partly why an Indonesian volcano is responsible for the Great Trek.
Fabulous, fabulous, fabulous. Johan Puri, thank you. Economic historian, professor of economics and history at Stellenbosch University. It is such a wonderful book. It really is. And it is a book that is so relatable because of its those sorts of anecdotes that are in it. It's also relatable because it draws on contemporary history and contemporary culture, board games, movies, all of that sort of stuff to which you relate. And so suddenly it's not a dry economics read. It is a read about why the world is the way it is. Lessons from 100,000 years of human history. And that's important because it's not economic history, it's human history, but it's about our long walk to economic freedom.